This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
What do you think about when you hear the name Jack London? Probably American heroes and adventure stories. But the author was also a social advocate who championed the poor and railed against income inequality.
If he came back now, he would shake his head and say, "What happened to you? I showed you the way. You have slipped back. You've regressed. You've got to do it all over again."
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the author of a new book on Jack London as an adventurer and social warrior. We'll also spend an academic minute looking at the influence of violent video games. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. From his childhood in factories and fishing boats to his earth-shattering sailing adventure as an adult, Jack London found himself face-to-face with the poor and the oppressed wherever he went, and he recounted their stories in gritty detail. Certainly, if you ask people about Jack London, he's usually remembered as the author of the adventure stories White Fang and The Call of the Wild. But in her new biography, Cecilia Tichy contends that Jack London was as much of a public intellectual as he was a writer. He was no apolitical adventurer, but a reporter who, through fiction and nonfiction, made no attempt to hide the horrors that he witnessed. The book is Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Cecilia Tichy is professor of English and American Studies at Vanderbilt University. She spoke about her book and the social activism of Jack London with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
Give me a sense as to what brought you to the subject and why you felt the need to write about him, and not so much about a full biography as much as his activism and what he did for the country.
You're so right, Joe. This book is about the arc of his career as a fighter, as the subtitle says, the fighter for a better America. London, and you know this, was born in America's Gilded Age. And in fact, these days, we're often reminded that we're in a new Gilded Age. I sometimes say no woman wants a gilded piece of jewelry. Why is that? Once the shine and the glitter wear off, as in Jack London's age, railroads, internationalism of America, a robust industrial economy, but underneath, people were really starving. Children were working long hours. Jack London, you just said it, himself did 10 cents an hour in a jute mill, in a cannery, in a steam laundry, where a friend of his says, "Jack, you've hired out as a slave. They've turned you into a robot." And then also, he got trapped into the seduction of the Horatio Alger myth. He was told that if he started at the bottom, shoveling coal into a fiery furnace to heat up a boiler for an electric company, start at the bottom, shoveling that coal, and he would just rise to the top. Well, he did. He shoveled and he shoveled. And then his wrists swelled and throbbed. He strapped leather around them and kept at it. He learned that he was being paid less than two previous shovelers who had quit. He realized that the Horatio myth was just that, and that tens of thousands of men, women, and children in America were, as he said, working out their lives in mills, and that the great tycoons who had made this industrial world were, and he said it, they're aloof from it, they're hostile to the world they've made, they're ignoring the very people who have made their success possible. So London took to the pen. I mean, he worked as hard as a writer as really he had in the mills, but he wrote, he embedded in his stories, 50 books, hundreds of short stories, he embedded in those lessons to try to get the public to realize what had to be done. A more progressive world needed to be shaped by public opinion and public policy. And I think it's obvious by now from what I've said, I think he speaks to the 21st century when we are once again in some of the travails of a Gilded Age, a second Gilded Age.
Certainly, we think of journalists as being a rather cynical lot, and that they're seasoned, and as they season, they see a lot of stuff and they become somewhat removed from it. The takeaway for me in the book was how much what he witnessed and how much of what he covered affected him.
You know, his very body was a kind of autobiography of the miseries of his era. The injuries he suffered on the job, including war correspondent stints in Mexico and in East Asia, when he wrote, "I smashed my ankles." Now, he always put forth publicly a persona of robust health, on the upswing, he often said, and he loved to present himself as a prize fighter. That fighter, he loved boxing, and it was so popular at the time. But he suffered from the injuries and the wounds from the jobs, and they were lodged in his muscle memory as well as in his body. You know, people said to him, "London, when you make some money as you're making now, you're going to forget all this social progress stuff. You're going to forget this politics that's got you kind of bedazzled by socialism. You're going to join us. We're the successful ones. We know how things really work." But he never forgot. He earned $1 million, the first million-dollar author earner in America, and you know, Joe, at the time, the nickel was the coin of our realm, and so he made a lot of money. He also spent a lot of money, but he never forgot those who were toiling as he had toiled and who needed help and needed people like him to sort of turn the ship of state around for the betterment of everybody.
You make the case in the book that while we think of this man as a fiction writer, of course, and as a war correspondent and as an adventurer, as you mentioned, he was also a public intellectual. That is often left out of our history of intellectualism in this country. Why do you think that is the case? Why have historians disregarded his work?
Well, you know, historians tend to look askance at literature as any kind of useful database. Historians, and I would say political scientists too, they'll make some exceptions for, say, Uncle Tom's Cabin that had some real impact at the time of the Civil War, and they'll call attention to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, calling attention to meat contamination, and still to this day, kind of a classic. And more recently, Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, so important in the conservative movement over the last couple of decades. But generally, nonetheless, there's a kind of obliviousness to the power of a good story. And that's what Jack London could produce. He said, "I can reach millions with my story. I can stir the heart as well as get inside the head." And his wife said, "Jack, you're a teacher to the very last breath of your body." And indeed, that's what he was doing, teaching. Now, I will say this, he had warnings, any fiction writer does. The Dean of American Literature at the time, William Dean Howells, said, "People don't like to read about the life of toil." And at the same time, London's kind of colleague, Stephen Crane, Red Badge of Courage author, he said, "Preaching is fatal to literature." So on the one side, don't write about hard work, toil. The other side, no preaching. And they were like a headset in London's ears. He knew that his livelihood had to come from enthusiasm. I started to say receptivity. Enthusiasm and an eagerness to read a Jack London story, a Jack London novel. His readers were the bread and butter that he depended on, but he knew that he would be able to embed lessons in the fiction, and that the fiction could be a great lever to stir public opinion to make a change. You know, there's a scene in his novel, Martin Eden, which is kind of an autobiographical novel. Mm. It's a scene in which Martin, sort of a London character, is working in a mountain resort laundry. It's a steam laundry. I mentioned it a few minutes ago. Scalding vats of starch, hissing irons, beyond 100 degrees in this laundry, subterranean laundry. Meanwhile, same resort. The guests are in the terrace in cool summer linens. They're sipping iced drinks and they're fanning themselves because it's so warm. But who has laundered, pressed, starched their clothes? Jack and his boss, Joe, in that laundry, toiling almost 24/7, almost, until the Martin character, who has brought books hoping he could read after work, realizes he's just brain dead. All he's good for is a shot of whiskey. But those scenes, the laundry juxtaposed to the cool terrace, those scenes ask a reader, what side are you on? Is this really fair? How can we fix this? How can we do better? Someone recently said to me of that whole novel, that's a scene I remember, that laundry. I said, yes, that's the embedded lesson in that novel. That's the takeaway. Whose side are you on? And can't we do better? And let's do better.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Cecilia Tichy continues. We'll hear about how one of America's most famous writers, Mark Twain, got a little snarky when he talked about Jack London. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Cecilia Tichy, professor of English and American Studies at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. She's speaking about her book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
Let's go to our old friend Mark Twain, who said, quote, "It would serve this man London right to have the working class get control of things. He would have to call out the militia to collect his royalties." What do we make of such a statement?
That's a real zinger from Mark Twain, basically challenging London. London, you think you're a big socialist. Well, you could just see if any of those working men that you so valorize and make heroic in your novels, would they really be able to govern? And London would answer, I think, look, what is socialism? We are social beings, human beings. Don't we want to live in a better society, social organization than we live in now? Wouldn't that be better? Aren't we willing to get after some of the corruption and the inequality, the unsafe workplaces? And so who is better equipped to take a hold than those who have worked in those places, who have almost forfeited their lives as child laborers, who have, for minor infractions, ended up in prisons and barely survived, as Jack himself did, for a month, at hard time for the crime of having no money near Niagara Falls, the whole country in a terrible depression. London wrote a couple of stories that speak exactly to Twain's complaint. One is The Dream of Debs. And it's about the world of Eugene Victor Debs, the great socialist, charismatic leader, sort of turn of the century times. London starts the story in a kind of mansion in which the master awakens, and strangely, his cream for his coffee is not there. And then it turns out his coffee is not there. And then it turns out that his stabled fine horses are not being cared for. And the story, you get what's happening. Every working person has gone on strike all across the country. And the elites, the upper class, have to realize the extent to which their lives depend on the skill and the energy of the workforce in the country, from stablemen to telegraph operators to farmers and so on and so on. And very quickly, the world of the elites goes savage and barbarous, and they themselves find themselves fighting over morsels of food. So London, I think, answered Twain with fiction, and he also answered Twain in a sense with his challenge, and he gave a lecture, gave several times the same lecture. Sometimes he called it the coming crisis, sometimes he called it revolution. He challenged this way: 80,000 children are working out their lives in textile mills in this country. How is that reasonable? Can the capitalist explain this? And then he paused so that the question could strike home, and he said, no, the great capitalist cannot explain it. He does not explain it. We need to take hold, people, and show what can be done to rectify these terrible injustices, this wealth inequality, starvation wages, lethal workplaces, and so on and so on. So his challenge to Twain would be, read my stories, read my life, and see who you, Mr. Twain, Mr. Clemens, depend upon for your daily bread.
My dad quoted Jack London often, and as I was reading this book, I kept on wondering, I was saying, well, I wonder if Pop knew that about Jack London, and he passed a few years ago, but I wonder if he knew the backstory, and it just made me wonder, does this context that you give us, do you think it changes the way that we read Jack London?
Well, Joe, I hope so. But still, let's bear in mind, Jack London was trying to be subtle enough not to lose his readers. But I think, for example, if we reread The Call of the Wild, and in high school, so many teachers celebrate freedom and individuality at the very end when the dog hero Buck breaks free and he's up in the Klondike, the Yukon, almost a mythic figure. I think what a lot of teachers fail to call attention to, and readers fail to notice, is the extent in that novel to which the dog hero is in harness with fellow work dogs, strapped in, lashed mercilessly by the musher, and mistreated, underfed. And when a dog seems to be depleted, its muscles completely worn out, it is, and this is a quote, got rid of. I think we're ready now to read about the industrial workers and what they went through. It's a kind of Aesop's fable if we read back into Call of the Wild. And I'll add one fillip here. Jack London called himself in these terrible, onerous jobs, burdensome jobs, he called himself a work beast. Work beast. Right now, we have Task Rabbit, a kind of handyman, handywoman, way to cobble together enough income to meet your rent, get some food on the table. And we might think maybe we've gone from beast to bunny, but we've got something of the same unstable, poorly paid, working condition for millions of people in this country. And Jack London deserves a reread so we can see how a writer can help move the country in a better direction. If he came back now, he would shake his head and say, what happened to you? I showed you the way. You have slipped back. You've regressed. You've got to do it all over again.
That idea of I've showed you the way, if you talked to him prior to his death and with the writing that he did, do you think he would feel that he made a difference?
I think he would feel that he was allied with others who were promoting the same sort of changes that he was advocating. A difference was that others, also public intellectuals, were in the professions. some college professors, some in the ministry, some in medicine, some in law. Louis Brandeis was one. They had official positions, and they had constituencies that were aligned with those official positions. So they worked. London worked with them. The difference is that in his fiction, he could move not just the mind, but the heart. And in his high level of skill as a writer, he could touch people, open their feelings for their fellow human beings, and join with the others who, from professional expertise, economics, religion, could help to move toward better laws. For example, the 1906 food and beverage law that the novel The Jungle promoted. I think London would say, look to the New Deal, and you'll see some of the strong positive outcome of what I was doing back in the first two decades of the 20th century.
Again, the name of Cecilia Tichy's new book is Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. She spoke to the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Can violence in video games cause players to be more violent in real life? That's been talked about a lot over the years, and it's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Are video games making you violent? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Chris Ferguson, psychologist at Stetson University, examines the correlation between violent games and actual violence.
Debates about violent media have gone on since at least the ancient Greeks. Despite thousands of years of debate and hundreds of more recent research studies, we've still been unable to decide whether violent media fuels societal violence. Surveys of both scholars and the general public indicate no consensus has formed, with just as many people doubting effects as believing in them. As experimental research studies have not been able to provide a conclusive answer to this question, one place to look for more answers is in regard to societal data itself. Does our consumption of violent movies or video games fluctuate in a way that predicts societal violence? Societal violence is complex, of course, but if media is the pervasive influence many claim, we ought to see some form of relationship. With this in mind, I conducted two studies examining how societal consumption of movie violence across the 20th century, as well as video game violence in more recent decades, correlated with societal violence. Results for movie violence were interesting. Violent movies were particularly popular before the 1930s, and then again in the latter half of the 20th century. At these temporal extremes, movie violence was related to decreased violence in society. But during the middle of the century, movie violence and societal violence did appear to correlate. Since this relationship reversed itself after 1990, it's now clear that this is what we call an ecological fallacy, a chance correlation that has no meaning, but probably looked meaningful at the time. By contrast, violent video game consumption was clearly related to decreased violent crime among youth. Put together, societal data do not support beliefs that violent media consumption by society is a meaningful contributor to violent criminal behavior.
That was Chris Ferguson of Stetson University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.